Ahoy.
Hi.
Well, howdy, folks. It's Friday, and we are drunk and retired.
So I just tried to scratch an itch I had. And yeah. It looks like I popped a scab, so I'm bleeding all over the place now. That's fun.
Oh, good.
Do you need to?
No, it's fine. As a diabetic, I'm always bleeding somewhere. Like that's part of the thing. When you get dealt that diabetic card in the game of life, you're like, oh, I'm just gonna have to be poked and prodded, and blood's gonna appear somewhere. As long as it's not like on my face and people aren't screaming, yeah, it's fine.
I'm more of a bleed internally kind of guy on the emotional side. So it's I appreciate you bleeding externally to let us know what's going on.
So. Roberg, that's what I'm here for. I'm here to support you no matter what.
See, it's like you know me.
Oh, that's good.
Well, hey, guys, there's a huge pile of garbage and dumpster files and dog do in it and all of the above happening. One of them relates to configuration management, but I know it hits close to home for this gang, so I want to tread lightly. Anyone need to talk about anything?
So hopefully if you have been listening to this for a while now, you know that Chef and I have had a very good relationship. I worked there for 5 years. Hell, you can't see it because this is an audio podcast, but behind me on my Zoom I actually have the info desk sign that I stole from ChefConf 2018 to say that, no, that was my job. Everybody sees that I the culture, the community, and at some points of the time, the company was basically my life.
You say too much else on that, I just want to make sure that we're all aware of exactly what we're talking about. So Chef, a few weeks ago, I guess, maybe a month ago, was acquired by Progress?
Yes. Not Progressive.
Right.
Progress.
Right. Progress. And then
the company name for irony.
Right. Yes, yesterday, exactly. A lot of folks got information about their retention or lack thereof at the new company. So there's a lot of sad people in our circles right now. And so that's really what we wanted to talk about. I figured I'd just give that context out quickly, JJ, and then flip it back to you to continue on with your hearts and feels.
Yeah. So the one thing I want to say from the get-go about all of this, I would not have where I am in my career right now today if it was not for the company, the open source project, and the community that was all around Chef. The open source piece of software. I mean, I completely acknowledge that. I would have been not as far in my career if I hadn't had it. I'd be a smaller version of JJ, if you will. But I know for a fact, a lot of my career, and I'm still bleeding everywhere. A lot of my career is based around that.
And I got to say, you. I guess lucked out by you got to work with Matt Ray a fair bit,
yes.
Kind of as your manager or as your lead. And I think there'd be very few people for like what we do as a job or as a career to be a better mentor than Matt Ray. So I think that really worked in your favor.
Matt Ray convinced me, like he showed me some paths that I just didn't know existed, and he saw the skills, and I'm forever grateful for those moments that I spent in a room that's actually smaller than my office right now with him in Austin, Texas, as I was helping him get the OpenStack community and Chef together. But let's bring out the scope a little bit and just talk about the company in general. If you have any history with in the industry, and you know kind of the story, I'm going to TLDR a little bit of it. Basically, it started a lot of the professional DevOps movement. A lot of the infrastructure is code using testing-driven development, things like that. And there were some very strong opinions inside of it that allowed for basically modern-day development practices on infrastructure. So a bunch of sysadmins no longer needed to do sysadmin-y things. They could use automation to actually make things happen. With what's happened with Progress, it's very obvious that they sold at a time that there's something, someone somewhere in some board, some high exec that was, they said they were part of the community, but they weren't actually part of the proletariat. They were very much part of the bourgeoisie, where they obviously wanted their money back. I mean, every company's a business, every company needs to make money. Like, what is the goal from Eliade, who wrote Goldratt?
To make money.
The goal is to make money. Yeah. So completely understand that. And plus, it's been already about 10 years. Like, it was time to sell to move on.
Yeah. I mean, they'd taken quite a lot of investment from quite a lot of like VC firms that expect pretty high returns.
Yep.
And so I guess they finally hit that point where they decided they weren't going to get those high returns. Yep. And so they just wanted to get what returns they could. Which, the thing I find really disappointing is there was a moment a few years ago where I feel like everyone was talking about that it was like the golden opportunity for Chef to make an exit. And that would have been to be acquired by one of the big folks like Microsoft, IBM, Oracle, right? Mm-hmm. And at that point, I feel like everyone would have made pretty good money, especially like, you know, the first 100 employees. I know Chef got to like 500 or something like that, yep. Right?
I was 75.
Yeah, exactly. So like JJ as employee number 75 should make decent money at a good acquisition, right? Mm-hmm. And I feel like the people in making the decisions didn't make the right decisions for the people that trusted them to make the right decisions. Right. As a startup founder, you have a responsibility to your employees who have put their trust in you and put their faith in you to exit at the right time and, you know, make everyone money or bring everybody into a company that's going to be like greater than the, you know, some of the two halves. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately that didn't happen. And I know it's easy to say with hindsight, this stuff, but I feel like, at the time, we were all talking about now is the perfect time. So this isn't purely hindsight. And so I just, it's a shame because I view the people that were running Chef at the time, who are definitely not the people that are running Chef now, really let people down. And I find it very difficult to have like positive thoughts towards people that I once held in quite high regard. And I find that pretty disappointing. And I know part of that is on me and the way I see the world and the way I see things. But I think, you know, there were some misses made and, you know, people like JJ who could have done hopefully quite well out of an exit.
Mm-hmm. Frankly speaking, I really didn't.
Didn't do great. But also,
I didn't lose money. I know of people who lost money.
Oh yeah, that's better than me so far. My batting average is negative, if that's even possible in that sport. Yeah.
I mean, you look at the Docker acquisition, everyone lost money.
Totally.
Like I heard horror stories of people losing seven figures.
Jesus.
Employees. That's rank and right. File.
That's not right.
Yeah, man. Well, so startup, there's a very obvious theme of the three of us, other than being bearded white dudes, we are all also at large corporations right now, and we all have plenty of scars from startup experiences. That it's such a complex set of circumstances. None of us have been in the C-level at a successful startup, so don't know exactly the pressures. We just know what we hear and what we've read about.
Give me five years. I'll be that C level. That's the term.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Yeah. I'm making a joke. Come on, Broberg. Come on.
It's not a joke. You could do it. I don't. So if there's anything I've learned about startups and CEOs, it's not a question of intellect or skill. Absolutely not. Or not so many of them would fail so miserably all the time. So with that in mind, all three of us are more than experienced enough to go start some stupid shit up. It's a question of whether we're willing to sacrifice all of our time and not care for anyone but our company. And that, I think, deforms you emotionally in a way I'm not willing to do right now. I hope to one day be in a mental state where I can resiliently package that up to the side so I can do the startup thing really well while also being a functioning adult. I don't see a lot of that happening, and I know personally I'm not there. So screw that noise. I didn't think of it as a joke. I thought of it more as like a goal. And if you want to, man, you've got my support, just none of my money, because you're not going to make me a dime.
It's good. By the way, so just I as think, a nice, no, hold oh, on, a quick ahead. Little side. Do you know what, like we did some research into Progress as they obviously announced the purchase. I bet you've already done this, but I got to ask the question, especially if you're listening to this. Out of all their software acquisitions, because we just bought companies for the last X amount of years. What is the one company that like what is their one product that have you seen their main product that anyone would know of? Like
Progress?
Like yeah, Progress.
Yeah, no one's ever heard of Progress.
Yeah. Well, do you know what they have? They have one acquisition that if you heard when I tell you it, you're like, that's where it went.
Heinz ketchup.
I don't know. What's up gold?
Yes. What's up gold?
Yeah. Wait, is that real? That's Wait, what's real. Up? What's up gold? I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
Paul looks broken. What is this?
Tell the story.
So, that was a guess. I heard someone mention What's Up Gold randomly the other day, and it might've been in conjunction with this, but I didn't register at the time.
Yeah.
So I just like threw it out as some weird old technology I've heard about recently. And I guess I got it.
So you look at Chef Automation, Infrastructure Automation, like you look at their whole platform, their whole like diverse portfolio. Chef doesn't fit anywhere in this whole ecosystem. And like the amount of how many people who got pushed out, and the way that Progress does their development cycles, it's very, 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 very obvious that the bourgeoisie of the company and the retention numbers that they have, they assume that they can get the retention and get the money out of it, not realizing the Herculean amount of effort you need to keep a chef infrastructure stable, especially at these large corporations. Like you need this is chef isn't easy. Whoever said it was easy is lying to you. It's hard. It's powerful as all hell, but it's very, very hard to master. And right, chef employees have mastered it. And they're just like, push them off the lifeboat.
Well, I would probably suggest that what we'll see is engineering effort on chef disappearing and it becoming a support effort. And you can support a massive pile of junk, not saying that chef is a massive pile of junk, by having large numbers of support, cheap support people, right? I think what we'll see is like chef had their annual revenue of like, I don't know, it's not a real number, $100 million. And you know, they had costs of maybe 150, of which 100 of that was employees, right? So you cut most of those employees and you cut some other costs, they're probably going to cut 100 out of that cost. And so now they're making 50 out of it. And as long as they can keep that 50 for a couple of years, they've like paid for itself with profit, right?
Yeah, it's true. And then they turn it. Yeah. And
I mean, it's a pretty classic acquisition for, you know, annual revenue play. You buy the revenue, you sell the costs.
Yeah.
And people are considered costs. And that is one of those things that if you can't swallow, don't lead a startup, don't lead a company. It sucks. It's great to get paid to do other stuff. So consider that.
So I know a lot of found up starters listen to this. And so I think some advice for you, like while you're at the top, like today, right now, you should be talking about a successful exit. And I think one prime candidate there is HashiCorp. I think HashiCorp is like right now, I mean, they could totally grow. They could totally get bigger. But like right now, they're in a spot where they could have a really successful exit. They can pick and choose who they, how they exit and how they get pulled into another company or go public or whatever their exit is, and make sure that all of their employees make some money.
I'm with you. From your words to someone's ear, that is into that. But yeah, also a good reminder, if you're thinking about joining a startup, consider the money you spend on percentages of the company to be just lotto tickets, and make sure you're living on enough. Sometimes lotto tickets do make people a lot of money. We've got plenty of friends that have done quite well. But yeah, I can show you examples of not doing well.
And it's important so to understand the tax implications of the choices you make around shares and options, as well as the actual shares and options themselves.
Because I have all my money's in Switzerland. Do surprised. I need to worry about this?
So that's a deep topic to go down, but I outside of my expertise. But exactly. Yeah. And startups. We're pouring one out for you, Chef Peoples.
Well, one last thing. Yeah, I was going to say one last thing about the whole startup thing, if you're thinking going down that path. Also realize we've said this a few times now, but to reiterate, it is a company. It needs to make money. It's really awesome to work with your friends sometimes, but at the same time, working with your friends can also be a disaster, right? Like, go in with your eyes open going into a startup, because there'll be dragons all over the place. And there's a siren's call. There's very much a siren's song. Yeah. There's a siren song there. Don't get me wrong. I loved every moment of it, but at the same time, I missed out on a lot of things too. Like in normal life, right? Like, because your life becomes a startup, you live and breathe that world. So,
But I also want to throw out, you know, I also want to balance that with the value of it. If you can tolerate the risk of it for a few years, like I guarantee I only make as much money as I do now because I have a lot of experience through startups where it becomes interesting to a company that you've been to more than one organization. So it's interesting to me, the way this stuff works out. But what's also interesting to me is the Instagram story you had this week, Paul, of some banana pudding that you put together. Tell us about banana pudding.
So banana pudding is like one of the disgusting classic desserts.
So gross. All bananas everywhere. Just
oh, you're ridiculous. Broken, man. Yeah. How do you get potassium in that big body of yours?
Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead, CZ.
There are some deep-seated issues from your childhood that maybe we should address sometime. But for now, we'll just move on and keep talking
bananas
about
don't have seeds. Banana pudding.
So banana pudding is kind of the go-to dessert for barbecue, especially Texas barbecue. Like, just about every barbecue restaurant in Texas has banana pudding. But unfortunately, it's almost always like banana flavored Cool Whip. And so it's still kind of delicious, but it's also banana flavored Cool Whip. So I've kind of been on a push to make a slightly better than that version of banana pudding. And so I've just been chipping away at recipes and stuff. And I've finally sort of hit something that's kind of taken what banana pudding is, but also kind of brought in what a tiramisu is. And so basically what I do is, so in a banana pudding, you have little cookies, Nilla wafers.
Okay, so no lady fingers.
Right, so I use those and I soak those in a little bit of rum. Although I may change which liquor I'm using because the rum is a little bit harsh. I then I make the banana pudding. And so to make the banana pudding, I actually first of all make a vanilla pudding. So I make a vanilla custard to which I add gelatin to turn it into a vanilla pudding. And I let that set. And then I take that, I take a can of condensed milk, and I take two very, very ripe bananas. And I blend all of that until it's like ultra smooth. And so that's kind of my banana pudding starter. And
I'm
then
I'm interested in the rum though, if I can interject. You said it was too sharp. What kind of rum did you use?
I used like a dark rum, like a fairly cheap dark rum, but I'm not a really a rum drinker, so I don't have any reason to have expensive rum. But I actually think like a lower percentage alcohol thing, like maybe like a fortified wine, like a Madeira or a sherry or something like that, might work better.
Totally fair. Yeah, I was curious because I recently am a convert to rum. I thought it was a terrible thing that no one should drink until I realized I only was imprinting on like cheap spiced rum, not actual rum. And Smith and Cross is like $25 a bottle, and it's absolutely perfection. It's so good. I make like a Smith and rum style old fashioned, subbing the bourbon for rum, and it's so smooth and so drinkable. It just tastes perfect.
Nice.
So,
have you ever had a Jim Jarlewski? This is a deep cut for some nerds out there that might be listening.
No, real deep cut.
Okay. Jim Jarlewski is rum and Gatorade. Yeah. Yellow Gatorade and rum. So the dad from Step by Step, Canadian, Alan. Fuck, what's his name? Alan. You know who I'm talking about, right? Like the dad.
Zero context. Nope.
Never watched Step by Step.
Nope.
Oh, I did, but not with the tension, obviously.
Okay. Well, he's a super, or he was, he passed, but he was a super, super famous Canadian actor. And Step by Step was his American breakout show. Well,
so when you say he passed, like go and he collected $200?
Yeah. But he
but in a spooky way.
Yeah. There you go. So he actually was in a show called J-Pod, Douglas Copeland book based about basically tech nerds in the gaming industry. And he played the dad in that also. And he was playing a mirror of himself when he'd gotten out of Step by Step. And all he did was just kind of like walk around aimlessly and drink Jim Jarlewski's, that was his name, which was Gatorade and rum. So again, very deep cut, obviously did not resonate with this, and I'm dropping it now, but
well, I hope somebody is laughing.
I'm glad we interrupted my banana pudding for that tangent.
Hey.
So now bananas are gross. No one's going to be able to follow my recipe now because of that interruption. So thank you very much, JJ.
I'm swimming.
Anyway, so we have the banana, almost banana pudding, right? So we have the bananas, the vanilla pudding, and the... What was the other thing? And the condensed milk, right? And so then I whip up, make a big thing of whipped cream, and I fold that through, and that sort of adds a bit of lightness and body to it, right? And so that's like that's what I call my banana pudding, like my ready to serve banana pudding. To turn it into kind of a tiramisu though, I then make a second batch of whipped cream to which I add a splash of rum and some sugar and like a little bit of milk powder. And what the milk powder does is it kind of fortifies the structure of the whipped cream, so it sort of holds its body for a little bit longer in a similar way to the gelatin does in the pudding side of things. And then so with all of those, I then do a layer of the cookies, a layer of the pudding, a layer of the cream, a layer of banana slices. Sorry, the banana slices go between the pudding and the cream, and then cookies, pudding, banana slices, etc. So just working my way up.
And that's so it's like a seven-layer dip, but banana pudding.
Sure.
Terrible analogy. So are you a fan? I mean, is it is it starting to meet that expectation that Texas barbecue joints have not been hitting for you?
Yeah, I think so. I have some tweaks. Like I said, I want to use a less strong liquor. I'm also thinking about doing like a drizzle of like dolce de leche or something on top of one or two of the layers. Because I feel like that'll like that kind of caramelly kind of flavor will go well with the banana.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I think we lost our diabetic friend who also hates bananas with right. this very deep look at a dessert. So what else are you two cooking or eating? Oh, that reminds me. I wanted to ask you about ramen. It's getting cooler out. I don't know where people are. It's getting cooler out where I live in the Midwest. And I really enjoyed like doing a ramen run. I've tried to go to every restaurant in the Twin Cities that had ramen so I can compare and contrast the shoyu in particular and try to find a happy place. And I found some good ones, found some bad ones, but I realize with COVID happening still, I need to start making this at home. So what are some tips on doctoring up some noodles?
So, I mean, first of all, you've got your like instant ramens, right? And they're pretty good and you can make a delicious instant ramen like by adding some stuff. For instance, I still have a bunch of that Tubai spicy fire noodle stuff from ages back. And so I actually had that for lunch today. And I just chopped a bunch of green onions and mixed that through it. And then I also mixed like a tablespoon of roasted sesame paste through it as well. But you could use like peanut butter or something instead. So it kind of almost gives it like almost like a satay kind of taste. And that was pretty delicious. I'll often like poach an egg while the noodles are cooking because you can just throw it straight in with the noodles. If it gets a little bit messy, it doesn't matter.
Is it all the way? Does it cook the egg all the way? Because the times I've done it, it doesn't seem like it does cook it all the way.
So you should get like at a 2 to 3 minute noodle cook, you should get to a pretty soft cooked poached egg.
Okay. And then it gets mixed in with the noodles when you mix it up. So it's all like attached to the noodles, right?
Yeah. Oh, so one thing you can do is if you have like a little ladle, actually crack the egg into the ladle and then lower the ladle in to the soup. And that way the ladle kind of protects the egg a little bit.
I'm into it, man. I fell in love with soft baked eggs or so I can do like a, you know, a semi... Oh, what do you call it? Like a semi-baked egg, like you would with a sous vide.
Like soft baked?
I said baked, but I meant what do you boiled. Call it when you
boiled.
Do
boiled.
It? Boiled. Yeah. Soft boiled.
Right, that's cool.
Oh, yeah, that's what
there, there is a weird school of thought that talks about actually baking eggs to get them, and it's a terrible idea, and you shouldn't do it. So I'm glad that it was just a misnomer,
not a not a terrible life decision.
But if you want to get good at boiling and peeling eggs, Kenji Alt Lopez actually did a massive experiment out of his restaurant. He did a write-up in New York Times and they had a bunch of volunteers in and they cooked and peeled like 1,000 eggs or something ridiculous. And they cooked through all the different methods and tested all the different tricks people have and came up with this is the way we got the most reliable, you know, eggs that also peeled well. Because my struggle with eggs has always been peeling them without tearing them apart.
The easiest way is to hire a ramen chef to come do it for you.
There is that.
I really enjoy it. I think I'm like, I'd say 4 out of 7 times I successfully peel and have a beautiful soft boiled egg that I can like slice in half and get that little gooiness. And those other ones, they're just like, you rip it in half like a frickin', like a monkey trying to eat spaghetti. It's just a hot mess.
So you might be ready to step up and do like a smoked scotch egg then.
That's the shit right there. Oh my God. Scotch eggs are my jam.
Yeah. I've only ever bought
them. My heart hates me though.
At restaurants. Yeah. My heart could definitely stop on that and not call it a loss. Yeah.
But the beauty of them is if you do it right, you can cook a bunch of them. Right, make the sausage around it all and just put them in your fridge and they last fucking forever. So
yeah, that's what I do.
Yeah, like you just like it's like a lunch. And if you do the breaded around it too, Like you can just be like on a Zoom call being like, oh, eating a Scotch egg, talking to somebody. It looks weird. Not that I've done this before.
That sounds repulsive, JJ. Like absolutely not business casual, let alone business professional.
I might have not wanted to be at that meeting. Yeah, I might not want to be at that meeting. And I'm like, I'm eating my lunch. I don't fucking care. Home.
So just to close up the ramen, if you want to make better like restaurant style like ramen, there's a couple of things. There's a YouTube channel called The Way of Ramen, and that's pretty good. He goes through a bunch of different ramen broths and whatnot. And there's also a guy, I think he's predominantly on Reddit, called The Ramen Lord. And he's kind of the Reddit resident like expert on all things ramen. So those are two excellent resources to work from.
There you have it. All right. I'll report back after a few attempts.
Also a slice of American cheese on top of your ramen.
I can't bring myself to do it. It is so weird. It's just doesn't feel right. Feels like you're being like, even though it's instant ramen from like May, what if the M1 MAU, you know what I'm talking about, right?
I mean, I know.
Like if even that was like the 30 cents of ramen, putting a piece of cheese, like the American cheese on it, just feels like I'm doing something wrong. Like,
all right. Well, if it makes you feel better, I have had expensive ramen in Tokyo where they put a slice of American cheese on it.
Is CZ flexing on us again?
Robert? I'm just saying, like, you don't have to feel bad about it. You don't have to feel weird about it because
you don't have to feel weird about it because I'm better than you and I'm telling you what to do.
That's exactly what I'm hearing.
I guess we can take that out of it.
The takeaway is don't be above it because you're already below me.
Well, exactly. Oh, that's good.
Oh man. Okay, so ramen knowledge officially dropped. Consider your cheese source. What else is happening in the tech or food?
I have to throw this out because I really want to hear y'all's opinion about this whole situation.
Did you put a bunch of cheese on a vegetable and call it healthy?
God damn it. No. The Hacktoberfest blowback. I need to hear what happened there. I have my opinions, but Broberg, I want you to start first. Tell me your vector of what happened and what you think we should have done as a community.
Well, quick check in. Do we all know what we're talking about? Paul,
Why don't you tell us? Are you familiar with Hacktoberfest? But it's less about me and more about our tens of listeners.
Yes, sure. I was just gauging if this was actually a yes, no, like I had hoped for, but it's not. So what we are discussing, Hacktoberfest is a community project started by DigitalOcean, and it's been in collaboration with Dev2 for the last couple of years. And what it is just a little tool set where they measure who completes a pull request on an open source project on GitHub during October, with the intention being to get a bunch of people to kind of do good deeds for each other, help people get ideas over the finish line, get new contributors to new projects. But no good deed goes unpunished in this case, where we've gotten to a situation this year in 2020 where there was an aggressive amount of pull requests coming in from people that were not part of a project, and they were begging to get it merged so that they could get a t-shirt, because that's one of the outcomes of Hacktoberfest, is you can earn a t-shirt. So people were gaming the system, like all systems naturally get to, where people kind of break things. So I'm going to spoil the conclusion real quick, because the team behind Hacktoberfest did a wonderful job of updating the code, where you only get points for the project if the repository, the community behind the code, has opted into it. So I feel like they fixed the challenge. But with that acknowledged, I would be interested in, you know, how you two are processing the good, the bad, and the ugly of that situation.
Yeah. So how about I take a swing? So I wasn't following it super closely, but I did start to see, I guess about a week ago, an uptick of people talking about getting like pull request spams. And like some of them were even like, yo dog, like merge this, I need my Hacktoberfest shirt and stuff like that. Like people weren't even being like, you know, weren't even hiding their real intention. And so a bunch of Kubernetes repos got hit by stuff. And so they got vocal, and that's kind of how I came across it. And at that point, there was already a few blog posts written about the perils of Hacktoberfest and how this isn't really the first year that this has happened, but it's the first year it's kind of exploded
quite viral.
This way. Mm-hmm. Gone viral, sure. We can use that term. And so level. I think there was enough people annoyed or angry at it that it kind of created enough of a, I guess, echo chamber where it actually people took notice. And so then it got hit on, I think I saw it on the Register and a few other sort of quasi-tech, quasi-news sites. And then I did see that there was some attempt to address the issues, but some of those attempts didn't really seem to be taken in as being done in a good spirit. And we're like, people were sort of tacking back at those requests saying, well, that's like, you know, the arsonist telling you that only you can prevent forest fires.
Weird.
Yeah.
Wait, but why such a harsh response though?
Well, I think people were already just kind of angry and so weren't willing to look past the effect and look at the possible, you know, reasons. You know, there was no malicious intent on the Hacktoberfests, like, you know, people that run it, right? But I think it was hard for people to look past the pain that was caused to them to see that.
Gotcha.
But also, yeah. I think, you know, it's the effect matters more than the intent, right? So, you know, even if you have good intentions, you know, it doesn't really excuse bad outcomes, you know, hurtful outcomes or whatever. Not that like annoying a bunch of open source nerds is really that hurtful, but you know, everyone in their circles have their things that hurt them, and for some people mm-hmm. this is that thing.
Yeah, people burn out pretty hard maintaining software, so I'm tend to be in favor of protecting them over whoever else is trying to participate. And you know, the blind spot of this initiative, once the popularity rises, is that it's pretty hard to set up a big project to have flyby contributors. Mm-hmm. You generally want somebody who's experienced in the code base, has built credibility, is following all the nuance of open issues and other things happening, and will contribute in a way that's, you know, congruent with all that context. So if you want to be involved in Kubernetes in a meaningful way, you're probably not going to have a meaningful PR for 6 months. Like mm-hmm. you need to really invest in a group. You need to show up to SIGs regularly. Mm-hmm. You need to know people because whether we like it or not, like code bases at that scale is a human dynamic. So yeah, the fly-by-night, the one-offs, like most projects don't really benefit from that too much. Some do a really good job of making that easy. Like my foray into giving a damn about open source was Homebrew, the command line utility on Macs. They merged a couple of pull requests of mine in like immediately. And I was just so blown away at how cool that was that I could improve something that I love that I got more into it. So it's definitely the positive and negative of that.
Yeah. So I think maybe one of the other reasons people took it negatively was because it is effectively like a marketing tool by the people that run it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, hell yeah.
And so usually anytime something is marketing driven, people don't give it the same benefit of the doubt they might give it otherwise.
I kind of wanted to put in my two cents here where, for me, Hacktoberfest has always been something I've always looked forward to every year, just because I use it as a way to see other open source projects and look for the communities that say, hey, like I even have it on my little Twitter tweet deck going, I'm searching Hacktoberfest for new tweets on Hacktober because people announce like, hey, I'm looking for committers for this project, I'm doing blah. And this tweet kind of gives me a quick little, you know, view into what's going on. I did some research into what actually, like, the logistics of what happened. And I can put the link in the show notes for this. But it turns out it was literally one YouTuber that sent out some wrong information to his huge audience on how to game the system, which was really, really unfortunate. If you read really deeply into Hacktoberfest, it turns out you didn't even need the things merged. You just need to open up four PRs on public GitHub. That means you can use your own repos and it counts. Like, if you actually read the instructions on what was going on, if you wanted to game the system, like, you got to do your homework, people. And it's really unfortunate to see how this all happened. I love the Hacktoberfest. I'm actually trying to get IBM involved next year. I've gotten some thumbs up from some executives saying that it's worth IBM trying to, like, get a higher involvement in Hacktoberfest, because with the right mental, like, scope of what it's trying to do, it's a really awesome tool. But to CZ's point, it is a big marketing push, and there was some grumblings about marketing inside of it, but I see it as information, right? I see it as another way that we can celebrate a month's time where open source becomes a center, the spotlight goes back on, goes on open source, and from whatever audience you're looking at. And we have an opportunity to highlight the beacon of humanity that is open source. I recently came to the conclusion that
beacon of humanity.
Yeah, no. Wow, so I'm about to.
Are we making the world a better place?
No. Well, hold on. As much as you're gonna take the piss on me about this, I came to this realization recently, especially in the world of 2020 that we live in. Open source, the way the open source communities come together, the way open source works together in general, in my strong opinion, is a beacon for hope for all humanity. Like, it really, like, the best, like, okay, of course there's bad actors inside of any open source community, but the actual idea that we can come together as disparaging humans and actually build something that scratches your itch as or their itch or whatever, shows that humanity still has some level of goodness inside of it. So for me, open source truly is a beacon of hope, especially in the world that we live in today.
So I agree. There is definitely that I'm a person and I want to scratch an itch and I'm going to create an open source project or work on an open source project. But most of the open source, especially that I see day to day, is very commercially driven. And I don't necessarily see that same, like, I don't see it through that same lens as you see it.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting to hear that take, because that's not the lens I see it. And therefore, I don't see that. But I guess I don't know what I'm saying. I think I disagree with you, but not because
with an acknowledgement of your inherent bias and bubble.
Yeah.
As somebody who's tried to push out of just the corporate bubble and play more in the, like, free as in freedom space of open source that is violently opposed to the corporate investment in it. There's a balance there for sure. And in that space, there are wonderful stories of how Linux enables people who can afford technology to have access to great technology and is connecting dots across the world. And to your point, JJ, you know, it's been on my book list for a while to read about the commons, like the caring for the commons. There's a foundational book where the term "the tragedy of the commons" comes from, that it explains the social dynamic also of caring for commons without incentives or without pay or without these things that open source does and doesn't cover. There's a great book we can refer to when I remember it that covers this kind of work, and I think that is really special. I also really like open source because it's the only thing I can think of that unites really intense libertarian beliefs and really intense socialist beliefs under the same working model. And anything that can span that gap is a godsend right now, because libertarianism is pretty stupid.
Damn truth. That's a damn truth. Okay, well, I think we're coming up to the end here. Is there any last thoughts? What's going on?
Paul, you're on mute.
Paul was on mute. Didn't we have some thoughts around a new segment, Matt?
We did, but talk about it didn't work out.
Yeah, but how about you talk about what your thoughts was, and then maybe we'll try and make a better effort at doing it next week.
So as fun as this is, it is fun to just brainstorm live with two goofy humans. I like structure sometimes, and I thought one of the structures and ways that we can push ourselves to make sure we're teaching each other new things and our listeners new things is if we can find something where we all don't know it, and the people that do know it help unravel it and explain it. And then the person that knows it, or who didn't know it at the beginning, then explains it back to confirm that they get it. And it's completely a stolen segment. They didn't copyright it, so I'm using it. My one of my favorite podcasts, Reply All, does a segment called Yes, Yes, No, where one of the people come to the show with a tweet that they can't figure out what it means, and the other two have to confirm whether they know it or not, and then explain it ad nauseum until it might take 45 minutes to get through all the nuances of memes. And I feel like there's like something meaty to that format that I really enjoy, that I think maybe, you know, you guys do for me with food all the time. I wonder if there's like a segment there that might be fun.
Yeah. Sounds like a good plan.
I'm definitely up for trying that. I got to say, in Reply All, some of those tweets are so ridiculously obscure. They must work really hard to find the tweets to do the yes, yes, no one.
They're so good. It's so, yeah, like the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse episode will forever, I think it was like 8 memes all mashed together and layered like a wonderful banana pudding.
Ew.
It just was magnificent. So yeah, I don't know, like maybe the homework for all three of us is like, look at a tweet about technology that you just don't know what it means. Or if you find a YouTube video, you're like, why are people cooking that? Bring that. So YouTube or Twitter, bring that next time. And we'll see if there's a, there, as they say.
Sounds perfect. All right, gentlemen. Bye.
Peace. Bye.